Welcome to the ICANN Conference Center, powered by Adigo Conferencing. www.adigo.com. This call may be recorded. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key or hash key.
Yeah, and I'll give you some feedback.
I'm sorry, your entry is incorrect. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key or hash key. Please wait for the subscriber. If you are the subscriber, press star. Please enter your subscriber PIN, followed by the pound sign.
You think you're all set?
Yeah, I'm ready now.
Okay. Yep. Uh-huh. Let me just enter these numbers and see if I can get into...
Please say your full name, then press the pound key or hash key. Thank you. Your conference will now start. You're the first. Join the conference. You may hear a list of available options at any time by touching star star.
Hello. Hello. Hello, this is Julie Hedlund, this is the ESSAC public meeting. We'll be starting momentarily, but I know we have someone on the phone. I think I just heard a sound. Who's on the line?
Second.
Maybe that was just me joining. Is there someone on the teleconference line? Okay, well, just give us a minute or so. We want to make sure that the slides are showing up in the Adobe Connect room properly so that the people joining remotely are seeing them. And so maybe just a minute or two, and now I see that Adobe Connect quit. So might be more than a minute. Thanks.
So good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. Okay. The reason why I asked that question twice is on this stage, just like in many of the other rooms, I hear absolutely nothing of what's coming out of the speakers, which might be a good thing, because if I pass around the microphone and you talk in the microphone, then I will not be able to hear what you're saying. So this morning in the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, we're sitting in the room with the most comfy chairs. It's the morning.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Who just joined on the line?
Barbara.
Hello, Barbara. Good morning. Thanks.
Well, yeah, good morning.
So it's... the morning after the excellent gala dinner. Thank you very much, CNIC Nick and all the other sponsors that managed to arrange that brilliant evening. I was myself this morning waking up sort of having jet lag, and I was thinking, I have jet lag again, and that's probably because I arrived here to Beijing last Thursday. So maybe it was a good gala. So now when we are sitting in the room with the most comfy chairs, And pretty nice, then we're going to be friends here together this morning. Maybe we should just turn down the light and have a little bit more soft and you can sleep. Soft music. So, a little bit more serious. Let's go into... We have an hour here, and I would like this to be as... Excuse me, who just joined?
Yeah, this is Alain.
Good morning.
Good morning, Patrick.
So what we're going to do here is to go through the, first of all, going to present a summary of what we have done in ESSAC this week, so we can So we can tell you a little bit about. Let's see. I need to open the slide myself. Just wait a second. I'm just going to show my slide, the slides myself.
We have a problem with Adobe Connect being sort of oversubscribed, so it's kicking me out like every few minutes. And as we found in the DNSSEC workshop yesterday, it's just really annoying for the people in the room that I have to reconnect to Adobe Connect every time that happens. But I do need to do that, or the people who aren't in the room won't see the slides. So we're going to share duties here. Sorry about that.
So I'm going to try to show the slides so that people here in the room at least can see what we want to present. Fantastic. There. So what we have done this week in ESSEC is that first of all we have had a couple of meetings in the following committees and work parties. The administrative committee met Friday and Saturday, almost a week ago. And the administrative committee consists of myself being chair, Jim Galvin, vice chair, Ram Mohan, the liaison to the board, and then staff. And it was Steve Cheng and Julie Hedlund that was participating locally. We also had a meeting in the membership committee that Jim Galvin is chairing. And the work part is for identify abuse metrics. Abuse of the DNS for distributed denial of service attacks did meet as well. We also had briefings at a number of public meetings. We gave an overview over the ESSEC update on the 2013 work plan. And we have presented information about SEC 57 and SEC 58. And those are the two reports that we also are thinking of discussing here today. In many of the meetings, just because we started with the SAC 57, we unfortunately didn't have time to go into SAC 58, but as many as you know, the SAC 57 report is the one that has created most interest here here in Beijing. So because of that, we have the ability at this meeting to give a little bit longer report on SAC 57 than what we have done at the various briefings, if it is the case that you're interested in that. We also, regarding DNSSEC, we were running the DNSSEC for everybody this morning. We had an DNSSEC implementers gathering on Monday evening. Thanks very much to the ones that helped sponsoring that. And then we also had the normal workshop, DNSSEC workshop, yesterday. We also would like to very explicitly thank everyone that participated and as speakers. And we talked a little bit this morning about the format, and we could probably have run that for 2 days instead of half a day because there were so many things to talk about, and we'll see how we are going to make that more efficient next time. But obviously that is something that is very, very interesting for people, and also like to thank Dan for Internet Society as well for trying to do this coordination, collaboration between the ISOC 360 program and what we are doing. I think that's yet another sign of good collaboration. And then we had a full meeting for all of ESSEC late Tuesday, where we discussed also the 2013 work plan. On the other hand, we, of course, were discussing the aftermath of SAC 57 quite a lot and namespace overlap. Apart from going through quite a large number of administrative things that we, of course, always have to talk about. We did go through, for example, process issues regarding membership. We also went through how to handle our bios and keep both bios and statement of interest information up to date and make that information about ESSEC members more clear and on the ICANN website. We have had various meetings with the community. We have met with the at-large advisory committee, CCNSO Tech Day. We presented there. We met with GNSO. We also had a meeting with the council, registered stakeholder group, and ISPC in separate meetings. We also had meetings Monday this week with law enforcement representatives. We both had ESSAC individuals that participated in large portions or even the whole day of the Monday. But then we also have a specific meeting between ESSAC and law enforcement where we were talking about both how we could do more things together and exchange information and try to basically help each other to be more efficient and create something in the future. We'll see what's going on. I also had a meeting with ICANN fellows yesterday morning, which was a great success. So I'm really happy for the cooperation that we have with the people running the fellowship program. And around the previous ICANN meeting, we actually, one of the ICANN fellows ended up being was accepted as an ESSAC member. So some people come from fellows directly to ESSAC, which I think is a very good thing. So while I switch the slides, is there anyone that have any questions on that?
Yeah, I can't hear the Adobe audio as a participant. Yeah, as a participant, I cannot hear the Adobe audio. So here I'm logged in as a participant. I'm getting nothing. I hear background.
So now over to sort of the normal program. So the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, we were initiated in 2001 and began operation in 2002. And we are 38 people at the moment, and the charter is to advise the ICANN community and board on matters relating to the security and integrity of the Internet's naming and address allocation systems. I've already gone through this. So the publications that we have released during 2012 and 2013 divided in categories are the following. Regarding DNS security and abuse, we produce SAC 53, 56, 57, and 58, where, as I showed earlier, 57 and 58 are the ones that we are going to go through a little bit more in detail later on today. Regarding internationalized domain names, we released SAC 52, on delegation of single character internationalized top-level domains. Regarding WHOIS, we sent in some comments on the WHOIS review team final report and also released a report on the domain name registration data model. And now a question to you. We have two alternatives here. Either I go through sort of an overview or SAC 57 and we can have a discussion, or I let Warren up on stage, and he can show you more precisely what the implications with SAC 57 actually is. Do you want? How many people would like to see what Warren actually has found regarding 57? Okay, good. I'm not going to ask the other question.
Wow. Good enough. We can hey, everyone. So you've probably, or you might have already seen this on, when was it, Monday, Tuesday? I'm going to go through it again, hopefully a little slower this time. And if any of this is unclear, please stop me, ask questions, etc. So, background. When you connect over to an HTTPS site, basically something we're using SSL or TLS to secure the connection, your browser actually uses a public key to encrypt the data. And it gets this public key and a certificate. And the reason that it trusts the certificate is that it's signed by a certification authority. And this signature binds the public key to an identity. So basically them signing it binds the public key that you get to something like www.example.com or something like that. And then when you actually use the certificate, your browser makes sure that the site it's connecting to matches the identity that's in the certificate. So before the CA can actually issue the certificate, they need to make sure that they're giving it to the right person. If they don't do this, somebody just showed up. If they don't do this, then you could perform a man-in-the-middle attack. So somebody else could get a certificate for a name. That person could then present it. The way they do the validation, at least for DV certificates, is they send an email to a specific address at the domain that you're trying to get a cert for. So if you're trying to get a cert for example.com, they'll send the email to hostmaster@example.com or webmaster or even the email that's in Whois. And then whoever receives this just replies back, and that proves that they own or control the domain. There's another type of certificate, which is called an internal server name certificate. And these are designed for internal only type things. Microsoft recommended for a long time that you use these. They don't recommend them anymore. But a lot of people have deployed them for Exchange, Active Directory, similar sorts of things. Lots of corporations use them internally to secure stuff. And the identity in these certificates is of the form www.corp or www.accounting or mail.test. And the only thing that makes an internal server name certificate different to a regular certificate is that it doesn't end in a TLD. That's the only difference. Because it doesn't end in a TLD, the CA can't actually send this validation email because it isn't a real domain to send it to. So they kind of skip that step. They're supposed to perform other validation. This doesn't always happen. So the fun part is when one of these internal server name certificate becomes a real certificate. Basically, if the last part of the identity gets delegated. And when this happens, potentially really bad things can happen. So to demonstrate that, I applied for a certificate for www.site. Site is actually an applied for TLD. And because I knew that the CA wasn't going to send me a validation email, I put in an interesting sort of organization name, Dulles Steel and Forge. And not enough people laughed last time, and I'm really happy with my pun, so. Okay, that'll do.
That is good enough.
So the CA actually popped up a little box warning me that this wouldn't work on the internet, and mainly just to protect myself. And so I said, okay, yeah, I realized that I'd like the cert anyway. 2 or 3 hours later, they emailed it to me, and here is my newly minted certificate. And you can see the identity in there is www.site. It also has another identity, which is just site, which I think was nice of them, but anyway. And then to demonstrate the issue with this, I set up a fake instance of the root. I delegated .site to myself. So basically, I made it look as though the site TLD now existed. And then I set up a web server that was serving the cert. And this works fine in Safari. Basically, I've now performed a man-in-the-middle attack against what would be site when it existed in the real world. It's all fair that it works in the browser. The browser is doing what it's supposed to do. It matches the identity to what's in the cert. The cert is validly signed, and so the browser's doing the right thing. Same thing happens in Chrome. I didn't bother putting in the slides, but also IE and Firefox and Opera and all the other browsers. This isn't unexpected. This is correct behavior. But what it does mean is that an attacker can get the list of applied for TLDs, and then they can go off to CAs and get a certificate for things that they are fairly sure will be delegated eventually. So, well-known names that they expect will show up in this TLD. They then wait until the TLD actually gets delegated, and then they perform in the man-in-the-middle attack. Basically they go out to a Starbucks and they set up a fake SSID, or they hang out in a hotel network, or potentially they run a small country, or something like that. Cache poisoning, DHCP poisoning, etc. And when a browser goes to one of the sites that the attacker has a cert for, they just present the cert. The user has no way of knowing that this isn't correct behavior, and they fill in their banking credentials. The user has a lock icon. They have no reason to suspect that anything odd is happening. And then, of course, the attacker runs off with all your money. So, Are we going to talk about the timeline or just what we suggested? Okay. So we wrote up this advisory. We did have a little bit of trouble because our advisories are normally public, and so we had to figure out a new way to publish this so that it had limited distribution. We got legal involved, et cetera. And we asked the security team to take over much of the mitigation, to reach out to the CAV Forum, who's the sort of industry group that represents a large number of CAs, not all of them, but a reasonable number. And we asked that they start treating applied for GLTs as TLDs as soon as possible. The security team also developed a vulnerability disclosure policy, largely based upon this, I believe, a communication plan to inform the affected parties, and a contingency plan in case this vulnerability in case the vulnerability leaked too early. And I think that's the end of my slides. Do you want to do the what happened?
Stay here.
Any
stay
questions here. Before we, or questions after?
And we can I can go through what actually happened first. So let's see. So this report we finished in early January, and just like Warren said, we came to the conclusion that this was pretty serious, and we could not make this public immediately, because then even though it's sort of known that these kind of things happens, if it is the case that we are writing on the nose of people, it might be the case that there is a big risk that people would run away and request these internal certificates before we actually had communication with CAB Forum. So what we decided, as Warren said, to hand this over to the ICANN security team under Jeff Moss, and what they did was that they alerted the CEO Browser Forum chairperson on January 23. Briefed the CAB Forum at its annual meeting on 5th of February, which was sort of kind of pure luck, but also a good thing. It was very convenient that they actually had a yearly meeting already planned. They wrote together Ballot 96 on new GTLDs. It was brought forward and passed by the CAB Forum on 20th of February. And the ballot says that CAs will stop issuing certificates that end in applied for GTLD strings within 30 days of ICANN signing the contract, and they will revoke any existing certificates within 120 days of ICANN signing the contract with the registrar operator. At this point in time, we, together with the ICANN security team, when we worked through like what are the actual impact of this, we decided, and we are now early March, we decided to make the whole report public. So the document, SAC 57, consists of our report, and then the timeline and list of events after the report was found, which is what you see under outcome here, but in a little bit more detail, you see that in Appendix A of the report itself. So now, any questions? We should have at least one microphone. Okay.
This is Mikey O'Connor. What's the proportion of certificate authorities you think that are covered by this? And maybe the converse question, which is how many of them are left, and what do we think the vulnerability that is?
We happen to have a person from CAB Forum here that I think is the right person to respond to that.
Okay.
Whoa.
I think your question was how many CAs actually issued these type of certs and how many certs there are?
The real question is how many of them are not going to be abiding by this outcome?
All of the major CAs will be abiding by it. And in fact, as an update, yesterday Mozilla started the process of adopting it as a mandatory part of their root requirement program. So every CA will be, if it passes through the Mozilla process, which it will, every CA will be abiding by this new rule.
Good. Great news. Thanks.
a clarification. I assume that that also means registration authorities, because eventually they chain up, right?
Yes, this the CAP form rules always apply to the delegated third parties.
Ram?
Thank you. This is Ram Mohan. Just a clarification question. Out there it says the CA will stop issuing certificates, and then there's a 120-day time period where CAs will revoke any existing certificates. Can we clarify for the group what ICANN intends to do? In other words, is ICANN going to wait on if they sign a contract with a new TLD registry, does this mean that ICANN intends to delay the delegation of that TLD for that 120 days?
I guess I'll try this. So I believe the wording is that ICANN will stop delegating 30 days after contract signing. I think that...
You said stop delegating. You mean stop issuing.
Stop issuing, yes. Thank you. Pardon? What did I say? I take back what I said. The CAs will stop issuing these 30 days after contract signing. I think that is likely to take more than 30 days between signing of contract and delegation anyway, but I don't actually know. I'll let somebody else do it because I have no...
Do we have anyone from ICANN here that can respond to that question? John? Yeah.
I can't respond to that question, but I think that's a question that's probably best put to the board and the executives, so maybe to the public forum. Get somebody to put it there. I don't think there's anybody in this room is going to be able to answer that.
Yeah, thank you. So let me clarify a little bit, because there's been a little bit confusing this week on the response to that and similar questions. And the reason why I don't answer is that there's a difference between what are the ESSAC work items, which are the actual tasks that we are working with, and the issues that are discussed in ESSAC and in the ICANN community. We in ESSAC very, very explicitly start to work on a specific issue that is based on a question or a trigger that is issued from someone, by someone, including ESSAC members that can initiate an issue discussion topic themselves. Like in this case, it was Warren that brought this to ESSAC's, that notified ESSAC about it. ESSAC then do work and release a report, which we just did. When we release the report, that is when we stop working on that specific issue formally. That doesn't mean that we stop thinking about those kind of topic-related items. But the ESSAC formal work has, at the moment, stopped. That doesn't mean that we can restart it or that we are not thinking about or not discussing these kind of issues. So that's where we are. And that's why it's not up to ESSAC to decide and answer the question that are instead is something to be brought up by the board or question the board, because we have now released our report and now it's up to sort of ICANN to act.
Thank you, Patrick. Just as a quick follow-up, I think at least I've heard some folks come up to me, I'm the ESSAC liaison to the board, and say, I've heard that the ESSAC recommendation is 120-day delay is necessary. So even though I recognize that it's not something that we have recommended to ICANN or something that we've even necessarily thought of, there is some level of conflation between what we're saying in our recommendation versus what some folks in the community are hearing about ICANN taking the 120 days and saying, until all the revocations are done, no delegation is done, because that is a right security and stability approach. So that's a reason why I think there's some conflation going on in people's minds.
Absolutely, and personally, speaking just personally, of course, as chair of ESSAC, I also, during specifically the last 2 days or something, I got that question quite a large number of times. Of course, that kind of discussion is exactly what might trigger us to actually do something or act, but But there is no, I don't see any sort of resolution of that discussion. Did you want to say something, Jim?
I've actually heard a couple times here people have said this, and I'm sorry, Ron, but even you just said it here too. We just need to be careful to understand that it's the CAs that have that 30-day window or 120-day window. It's not ICANN. So it's the CAs that are going to take that action. And I guess the concern here is you're suggesting that ICANN negotiated for the 30 or 120 days, and that's what the CAs are going to do.
No, that's not what he said. Okay. It's early in the morning, yeah. And we should not dig this hole in the ground deeper. We have our report. We are reporting back that this is the resolution from the CAB forum. Okay. Now, the question is, does that imply that ICANN should have some extra policy or something to the delegation? That is up in the air. We have issued our report. You can read it yourself. That's where the ESSAC formal work stopped. But once again, that doesn't mean that we as individuals, you sitting there, regardless of whether you're an ESSAC member or not, have stopped thinking about the issue. Okay. I think that's where we are.
Patrick Rubinsky. I have a question for the CAB forum. I know they can release the full corpus of the certificates, but couldn't they measure and aggregate per current invalid TLD? Say they asked their members to say, oh, how many .corp certificates were issued? And then they report in aggregate to the community. Not as DCA has searched. They will know that, but they wouldn't report that to us. They would just report, this TLD has that many certificates, this TLD has that many certificates. So you would have a list to base risk analysis.
So do we have a response there? I think if we leave the microphones on, I think it's
okay.
Better.
Yeah, that work is actually being done through a group called the CASC, which is the CA Security Council, and I'm hoping that we'll publish it shortly. It's a lot, though, because this was a recommended practice up until 2011 by a lot of the server software. In fact, it would auto-configure your network that way. So you're seeing a lot of small and medium businesses that actually have it pre-configured.
Next question.
Greg Aaron. Rom, I think one of the questions that should be asked is, once ICANN signs a contract, will the staff have a process for immediately reaching out to CAB and letting them know?
Next.
Stan York, I want to switch a little bit on a topic, and maybe it's just that it's early in the morning and I've only had 3 hours sleep. But, Warren, when you talk about this, could you explain a bit about the actual attack surface, I guess I'd say, because if I think about it, in your example where you have www.site, if that's something that's out there, in order for this attack to really impact me, I've got to be on a network where somebody else in the middle there has a www. And I've got to be going to a www.bank.site, first of all. I've got to go to that first. And then as I go there, somebody has to be in the middle somewhere in order to be hijacking this. So how does that – what's the realistic risk here in terms of people and the exposure that's out here? I totally agree this is a bad thing, so don't get me wrong about that. I'm just more looking to try to understand the risk. Thanks.
So, I mean, if these get issued, it's not going to be happening everywhere. You would need to be on a network or in a location where somebody is able to present the certificate to you. We have seen instances of this happening in organizations, some place where an employer would like to know what their employees is doing. That's potentially reasonable. There were also sorts of things where in certain countries, people have had a large amount of the country going through something like this. I mean, if you look at like the Dikhi Nuatar event, these certificates could be used somewhere like that. But also, if it's a organized group, they could have a number of people, for example, standing up fake SSIDs in airports or coffee shops. So, right. Yes, this isn't the end of the world.
But I guess my question is, what's that? I mean, that same attack that you've mentioned there with DigiNotar, with SSID, any of that type of thing, could be done against any SSL certificates. I mean, it's a generic attack that could be done against anything that's out there.
The thing is, you need a signed certificate for the person to be vulnerable.
Yep.
And what this does is it gives you a validly signed certificate. So the difference between this attack and a different one is that you actually have a valid certificate. Basically, what this means is any place where somebody can perform a man-in-the-middle attack, they could now potentially provide you with a real certificate that your browser would believe. When I am at Starbucks and I go to my bank, because I have the lock icon currently, I believe it's secure. I would not necessarily be able to after this sort of issue.
Okay, thanks.
Steve?
Greg, regarding your question about notification, so...
Can you hold the microphone closer to your mouth, please?
I can set up a notification service to the CAs and browsers. So there are some CAs not on the CA browser forum. What we did is we reach out to Mozilla, and Mozilla asked all their CAs that use their rule list to sign up for this service. So even if you are CA not on the CA browser forum, because of this Mozilla requirement, they have to sign up for this service. So we already got a lot of subscriptions. In terms of the service itself, we will push out first all the list of applied for TLD strings, order their priority numbers. So that will give the CAs a sufficient warning ahead of time. After that, whenever each contract is signed with ICANN, we'll push out that notification for the CAs. And we're also working with Microsoft for them to get their CAs sign up for their service. Thanks.
Warren?
And just a quick follow-up to what Steve said, it's not just Mozilla who uses the Mozilla list. A large number of people sort of inherit the Mozilla list of which CAs are in the group store.
David?
I'm curious as to if ICANN staff or anyone else has actually looked at sort of the non-browser software side of this. For example, like I'm sure iOS has deeply embedded in its developers' kits mechanisms which go and fetch and validate URLs through X509 certs. And I'm just wondering if there's been sort of an attempt to broaden the scope beyond just the browser world.
So, I think I can respond to that. There have been a number of suggestions that one of the places to mitigate this is in the browser. It's like the browser would look to see whether or not their certificate was issued after the TLD went live and things like that. To me, that seems like the wrong approach because there are a huge number of protocols that rely on these certs. But the great thing is because this CAV forum members and it seems like most of the other CAs are going to stop issuing these, that problem sort of solves itself. If it's not a validly signed certificate or if it's expired, it doesn't really affect anyone. But great question.
And I think that is a valid question for all definitions of iOS. Hooray, people are laughing a little bit.
Hey, they laughed for my pun.
Yeah. So any other questions, or should we move on to the next topic? So let's do the next topic. Jim, over to you. And I'll skip the slide, so just let me know when you want to swap.
Okay, so this is SAC 58. Our report on registration data validation taxonomy. In the same way that we had approached the who is term some time ago and published a taxonomy for that, we took a look at the discussion about validation and have done the same thing here, and we simply wanted to realize and separate for the community that there are several different topics for discussion here in validation and hopefully contribute and facilitate to a better discussion about validation in the community, validation of registration data. So next slide. I think it's already self-evident that the quality of domain name registration data is important,
and useful. There are a variety of reasons, and different stakeholders have different purposes for that data. So we took a look not only at the taxonomy, but we also looked at some of the techniques that are used for validation, also in an attempt to separate the discussion and get people to realize that different things are more effective than other things. So next slide. Okay. So taking a look at the specific findings that we had, the first one, again, it should be fairly self-evident that the quality of data is really relative to the registrants and their purposes. There are different stakeholders for different elements of the data that's collected, and they all have different reasons for wanting it, and therefore they also have different quality that they might be looking for. The reason why this is important is because there are different mechanisms that you can use for validating the data, and if you need very high-quality data, then you want to employ a more expensive or time-intensive validation technique. And if you have data which you don't need to be, which you understand could be volatile, might change frequently, you might not want to use a very expensive technique for validation. You just need a mechanism that confirms that it's effective. The second finding, of course, is that some validation technique can be automated and some cannot. And this was something that we really wanted to focus on a bit. In our experience in watching some of these conversations about validation, you find that different stakeholders, because they have different things in mind, different purposes for validation, different mechanisms in mind, they're often talking past each other. They don't appreciate that things that can be validated, would typically be less expensive, less costly to implement, but some things cannot be done in an automated way. So we want to try to look at those kinds of things that can be automated and separate them from the mechanisms that cannot be, so that we can be clear about what we're talking about. And then third finding is obviously that different data elements have different cost structures. Again, the obvious example is looking at an email address and whether or not it's effective. It's typically something that you can partially automate. If you look at a postal address for contact information, it really would be impossible, nearly impossible, to automate that and determine whether or not it's a valid address. And so it's just important to call out those different cost structures. Next slide. So we have three recommendations for the community. The first one is the taxonomy itself. So we have three phrases. We've separated taxonomy validation into three categories. And the first thing to emphasize about these three choices is that they are peers to each other. They are not intended to be ordered or suggest that one is any better than another. Different validation techniques and mechanisms will be appropriate for different circumstances, and that's what's essential here. So syntactic validation is all about whether or not the data actually looks like what it's supposed to represent. Easy examples are, is an email address really an email address? Does it look like an email address? You know, is it a left-hand side, an at, and a right-hand side? A phone number, you know, is the phone number actually look like a phone number? Does the phone number actually have, is it being input in a syntax that looks like it should for the region of the contact information that's been submitted? Okay. These kinds of things are also expected to be automated. The expectation about syntactic validation is all of these kinds of tests could be done in line with a registration process, because it should be possible to automate this process and thus make that decision very quickly. And ideally, that would be something that, in fact, would be done by everyone. That could be a baseline or a minimum and an expectation that one could have of everyone. Operational validation is the assessment that the data that you're looking at will actually work in the way in which it's intended. So again, in the case of an email address, can I actually deliver an email message to that email address? Will it take a message from me? In the case of a phone number, can I make a call? Can I attempt to connect a call, and will something answer on the other end? So is it a connected line? And note explicitly that this is distinct from identity validation, which is, given an email address, is it an email address that actually represents the real-world identity behind it? Is it the same real-world identity that's the registrant that you're looking for? And the same thing with a phone number. They might enter a valid phone number, but is it actually their phone number or a phone number that is a way to get at them? In the case of operational validation, the expectation is that some of this, though not all, could in fact also be automated. The email address is sort of the easy example because email servers in today's world actually do a variety of things. There are some that will simply, they won't answer a question of whether or not an email address is valid. You actually have to try to deliver or not deliver. So, I mean, there is actually a command that allows you to query email servers and ask them if an address is valid. But in today's world, there are many servers that simply won't respond to that query anymore. The other problem you have is there are also servers that simply will take all messages in and they decide later what they're going to do with it. So just the fact that you can give it a message or doesn't mean anything to you, you still have to be able to process any failed message that you might get or message notification that you might get after the fact. So, and that's true for a lot of things. So some things can be automated as far as operational validation is concerned, but many things cannot be. Identity validation is the other end of the extreme. The expectation there is that's probably largely manual, and most things would be, and it would require human intervention. So anything that falls into that category, like whether or not a postal address is a deliverable address or not, is definitely something that could not be done in line with a registration process. You would have to do that after the fact using some other manual mechanism. Next slide. So the second recommendation is to try and lay out the questions that need to be asked in deciding how to apply these three types of validation and how do you make a choice as to which one you want to use. So what we've proposed here is at least these four questions that would need to be considered and answered as a way of deciding which one of these validation categories and which technique you want to look for, which one you would want to use. So obviously in the first case, you know, again, getting back to this point, we collect a fair amount of data. Different people have different purposes for that data. And for that reason, they have different qualities or different levels of validation that they might require for that data. And so it's important really to look at the data and to think about what you're doing with it and who's going to use it. To a large extent, this is a question which is going to be answered by the expert working group that we have on directory services. So those things are happening in tandem, but our expectation at this point is that that question would be mostly answered by that group, ideally. In the second case, gets to the question of whether or not validation should be done in line or not. And we have tried in our separation the validation techniques to speak directly to this question. Anything that falls into the category of syntactic validation, again, the expectation is that you could do that in line and it could be automated. And therefore, it could be something which perhaps could be declared for everyone to do and become a minimum part of the registration process. And other things such as identity validation, there would have to be different processes set in place to handle that. But you couldn't do it in line because it simply would take too long. There'd be too great a delay in the registration process. In the case of the third question, obviously there's different cost factors associated with all the validation techniques. And you really do have to ask yourself what value you're getting out of applying a high-cost validation technique to data which is low-cost. And the canonical example here is email addresses versus postal information. Email addresses are quite volatile and would change quite frequently. And in that sense, you wouldn't typically want to apply a very high-cost validation technique to testing an email address since you would have to be applying it quite frequently. Postal addresses, on the other hand, tend to be less volatile. So they don't change quite as often, and therefore applying a higher cost technique is probably more appropriate. And then, of course, the last question is the natural tension between accurate data and the privacy wishes of the registrants in particular who are contributing the data. This is also a question which we expect to get some guidance from the expert working group on directory services, which is now engaged. So hopefully there'll be a significant contribution to that question for future consideration by people applying validation. And the last recommendation is explicitly to call out that we suggest the community seek to identify validation techniques that can be automated. We have identified just a couple as examples in this document, but clearly, you know, some effort should be put into identifying those things that can be automated so that we can have this baseline and thus, in fact, improve overall the quality of registration data. There certainly is a great deal of value in doing that. We do have to answer some other questions. It's not a singular question, you know, for example, the privacy considerations, but we should seek to find those techniques that can be automated and then incent their development and deployment so that everybody has them and we can all do them and improve the system in general. And that's it. Thank you.
Is there any questions?
Hello, this is Milton Mueller from Syracuse University. I just did want to flag, when you talk about identity verification, you certainly are talking about a policy issue of enormous consequence if you're talking about global linkage of the registrant to real name identity cards, you know, on a global basis. That's a pretty, let's say, interesting change in global policy. Maybe you're not talking about that. Maybe you're talking about these more automated telephone number validation techniques and so on. But my question about that is, okay, what is the net gain in the actual security and stability of the Internet by automating that? Have you actually been able to get a handle on that in a quantitative sense? In other words, are you constantly validating this, or are you at the initial point of registration validating it? When you actually do have an accurate telephone number, are you trying to stop people from making mistakes when they enter the data, or are you really trying to stop people who are trying to fool the system? You know, are the costs and the benefits really commensurate in this case? Has any actual thought been given to that or research been given to that?
So you asked some very good questions, and I thank you for those. But this document and the work that we did actually does not speak to those questions directly. Our goal with this document was simply to establish a framework in which to have the discussions about the questions that you're asking, what policies to apply and when. So questions about revalidation you know, how that applies and when it should be applied is not something that we did and we talked about. And it's not currently a work item in ESSAC. And I'm not aware of any research in that space. I don't know if anyone has anything else they would want to add to that.
Thanks very much. My name is Stephanie Perrin, and I am on the expert working group that's looking at the future services. And my perspective is largely that of data protection. My question is, and I do apologize, I came in a little late, so maybe you dealt with it. Have you looked at authentication of the individuals or organizations that are interested in accessing the data? In other words, more or less a tiered and authenticated structure of the requesters of the information rather than the other way around?
So, no, we have not at this time looked at access to the data and what it means to do that, except to the extent that we've actually asked that same question. If you look at the prior SAC report in where we talked about the our response to the review team, one of the questions that we called out explicitly is exactly that. When you're looking at the purpose of the data, an important consideration is who needs to have access to that data and why, and then, in fact, separate from that, one should talk about the mechanisms for doing that. So we actually raised those questions and put them out there, but we have not tried to answer them, no. I understand we have I understand we have a question in the chat room. Do you want to read that, Julie?
Yes. Thank you very much, Jim. This is a question from Alejandro Pusanti. He says, it is important to go back to the the large at large elections to see how bad things can get with verification. It has to be adapted by country and even sector. Even middle development countries like Mexico may have near useless postal systems. Large e-commerce companies may be a good source of views on how to manage this.
So thank you for that, Alejandro. And I think the short answer is yes, we agree. Even on our work party, we had a bit of discussion about that and about postal databases and their use. We did have a couple of people who had some experience in working with them, and they are very different throughout the world. You can cover a lot of the world with postal databases for identity validation in that context, but it's not perfect, and it certainly doesn't cover all of the world either. So there are issues there. Thank you.
Thanks, Wendy Seltzer. I appreciated that in the report you mentioned some of the sort of attacks that verification might make possible, like the if you're using email to validate and activate a domain, then attacks against the email address and phishing attacks might actually get it be increased through the use of that mechanisms. And I wonder if in presenting this further or in the recommendations around what might be automated, you might make mention of that. The more of these validations are automated, the more opportunities arise to automate the attacks in response.
So, yes, thank you for that. We actually explicitly chose a particular scope for this document in wanting to stick to the taxonomy. We did have some discussions about those issues, but we chose not to go down that path. That's a rather detailed and lengthy kind of study and report to really look at those mechanisms and talk about them in some detail. I think that if that's something that you would be interested in, we would need to be asked that question to visit and examine those kinds of things, if that's what you would like. Maybe Patrick would want to speak to that. No.
I think many of us now look at also what the expert group is currently doing and what they are going to do. And I think specifically in the area surrounding to Whois, just because all of us have scars from Whois discussions. I think myself, I started to work on Whois and white pages things in the ITF in 1992. That was actually that brought me into that process. And the first seven groups, I think, that said we're going to solve the white pages program, they went away and I've never seen them since. So I think it's very important that we do move forward one step at a time and try to do it in a coordinated way, because even though it takes a little bit longer time, I think that's the only way to finally try to come up with something that's sort of is acceptable and what we need and not more.
Any other questions or comments? Nothing else in the chat room?
This is actually absolutely brilliant, because I think we're about 3 seconds to nine when this session is supposed to end. So you've done a really good job. Thank you very much for coming. And I would like to thank all the ESSAC members that are in the room here. Can you raise your hand, please? So here you see the one you can, all of you see who you can talk to if you have more questions about ESSAC. And we'll be around a little bit longer. So have a nice continued stay in Beijing. Thank you.